to encourage everyone to take one or two or three. I'm sure your family and friends would like them. That way I don't have to take them back to California. While those are going around, I'd be interested in asking how many of you are, excuse me, I'd be interested in knowing how many of you are either catalogers in a university or research library, or how many of you have had a fair amount of experience in cataloging information that you receive in libraries. I mean, could you raise your hand if you're fairly familiar with cataloging? The reason I ask this is that I think I prepared my paper with a couple of misconceptions. As I've been sitting around the last few days, I'm revising some of my thoughts. I'm new to this organization, and I was figuring that probably the majority of us would be private collectors with very little library expertise, and maybe even less computer expertise. And I'm beginning to think that this is maybe not necessarily the case. I was interested in the last presentation where phrases and words such as open entries, tracings, the 028 field, the 500 field, delimiter P, delimiter D, qualifiers, the name authority work, where these were presented. Were any of you lost by this? I mean, you all know exactly what this was.
You never understand a word he said.
I know.
I didn't understand Ray Kirkland after every two lines.
I feel better. I've worked in the University of California at Irvine Library, catalog department in the library there for a fair number of years, almost 20 years. This is my 20th year there. And it's a great tendency to just throw around library terminology, cataloging terminology, and I have tried not to do that in this paper. I'm approaching it from the different end, as was mentioned before, that of how you can, if you decide that you want to do that, how you can make a catalog from your personal computer rather than an institutional approach. I'm sure that we've all had the experience of trying to find a record that we think that we have in the collection, and you go hunting around and you can't find it. You think, well, maybe I don't really have it. And of course, the larger your collection becomes, the more acute this problem is. And I think while memory can serve fairly well up to a certain point, there comes a time when your collection becomes large enough that you go insane trying to find something that you don't have in the first place. And so I think a catalog of the collection, if it's thoughtfully constructed, can be of a great benefit. Obviously, in the few minutes, and of course I know we're running late, so I'm going to make some cuts as we go here. In the few minutes that I've got here, I'm not going to tell you how to catalog a record. And I'm not going to tell you how to work a PC. So what am I going to do? I will sit down. No. What I'm going to do is try to give you some things to think about, whether you really want to have a catalog, if you do, what type of a catalog, and some of the things that you might consider. I have intentionally omitted any mention of specific companies, either in software or hardware, because I'm not trying to endorse or withhold endorsement from any particular company, because there's no particular point in that. The types of software I'm mentioning are put out by innumerable companies, and so the principle is the same. I think if you decide that a catalog would be helpful for your collection, the first thing that you have to decide is what kind of a catalog. And I think the one that we're most familiar with probably is the card catalog, which is an alphabetically, usually, arranged list of cards with entries or cards made for composers, titles, performers, genre headings such as symphonies or operas or symphonic poems or whatever. More complete catalogs also provide information by manufacturer label number and matrix numbers, as we've talked about just earlier. Depending on the size of your collection, it might be a good idea to consider a machine-readable catalog, which can be developed using a personal computer. If it's properly constructed, and of course this is always the caveat that you run into, if it's well made, and if you think about it ahead of time and do a lot of planning, it can allow you to do everything that the card catalog would, and other things in considerably less time. If your collection is small enough, and we'll talk about what is small and what is large, if you can even put numbers on it, a word processing program alone might provide sufficient control. I have a friend who, a couple of weeks ago, was telling me that, my gosh, my record collection has become so large now that I need to start making a catalog for it. And he came in to talk about various ways that he could do this. And it turns out later in the discussion that this collection, which had become so enormous, had a little over 50 records. And I mean, my personal collection is probably, I know it's over 5,000, which is large in comparison to his, but small in comparison to many of yours. And so it's kind of difficult to define what is a large or a small collection for the, and you could quibble with any of these things, but for the purpose of this paper, I'm saying that if you've got about 500 records or fewer, that is probably considered a small personal record collection. Anything above that is maybe medium, and a lot of them are over 5,000 records. In any event, the first task that you have to do is to define what information you want to get from your computer or from your catalog, whatever, however you're going to go about it, because the information that you want to get out of it will determine what you need to put into it, and this is something that a lot of people think about too late. For example, you might decide that you're only going to want 5 pieces of information. And this is geared toward classical music, and so rather than pop music, and so there are a few differences we'll talk about from the ones that we were looking at earlier. Forming group, the manufacturer label number, and some type of a call number. I don't know what else to call it except a call number of your own devising, which will enable you, once you get the entry, to find this thing in your collection. And what kind of a call number you use is entirely up to your own. You can use an accession number from 1 to 5,000, or you can break your collection into groups like symphonies and operas and chamber music and give numbers to those. That's up to you. But you need to have some way to get to the recording once you have found it listed in your catalog. I think you need to be very methodical here and prepare a written list of these attributes like the composer and the label number and the title, because you're going to forget. And it's very important that you don't rely on memory alone, because you will end up with devastating consequences later, sometimes devastating. So if you've got your list of information that you want to get from the computer, you can sit down and start inputting information into your computer. Now, see, we're still on word processing programs, and you can input these in almost any order that you want. I think it's a good idea to sit down and work out some kind of a systematic order so that each time you do it the same way. But with word processing programs, you can be very, very flexible. Almost any type of a word processing program will allow you to search for the occurrence of any word, phrase, or number. And so you could conceivably find a particular Ned Rorem recording that you have in your collection simply by asking the computer to search for Rorem. If your collection is small enough, that would help. It does mean, though, that if you were to try to find all of the recordings that you had with pianist Edwin Fischer playing, you might have to go through several repeat searches in order to get, you know, Bach and all of the different composers that he recorded, because these word processing programs will only search for one phrase or word or number at a time. That can become kind of awkward and frustrating. There are lots of drawbacks in word processing programs, but at least they're easy to construct, they're easy to access to get the information from the computer, and if you need to, you can change and make modifications along the way. If you decide later that you want to get at a matrix number, sure, you've got to go back to the 500 that you've already done and input that information, but you can do it with a word processing program. If you look at your handout, the first example, two lines, extremely simple. An entry which would offend most catalogers, I'm sure, in some ways, but it might serve a purpose for some collections if your collections are small enough and you don't need a great deal of sophistication. You got the composer. These are just the elements that I mentioned before. You have the composer's name, the title of the piece, the performing group, in this case also the conductor, performer, the label number, and the call number. If you want to get a little bit more sophisticated, you can go into a database program. And if that's properly constructed, I'm trying to figure out how to make the best cuts here. Well, you would be able to locate in just a few seconds something very specific, like a 1986, I just happen to have this in my collection, the 1986 recording which Glenn Gould made in Salzburg of Schoenberg's Opus 25 Suite. Okay, that's quite a bit of information, but in one pass, a database program, if you worked it out ahead of time, could find that very quickly, whereas a word processing program might take a little bit of time. As I mentioned earlier, word processing programs allow a large degree of freedom, but database programs usually do not. They're usually very rigid. Once you've decided what you want to get from the computer and then you change your mind later, you may not even be able to make that change without re-inputting all of the information that you had previously put in. Depends on the program. Some of them do and some of them don't. Example two, moving right along, shows how a typical database program could be constructed in fields. Composer, title, conductor, performing group, soloist, manufacturing, label number, physical format, call number. You could have fewer fields than these, you could have more. If you want to look down at example three, you'll see a list of some additional fields that you might want to include. I think with time marching on as it is, or running on as it is, I'm not going to be able to take the time to go through and explain what all of these mean, unfortunately, except I think I'm going to pick out a couple, particularly the one over on that right column that says uniform title, because this is something that some of you perhaps haven't thought about. If I can get to my little notes here, potentially this is a very useful field. It's a title, it's kind of a made-up synthetic title, which is formulated by a combination of such things as a genre, performance medium, and an opus number, and a key, if you have any or all of those parts. Example four shows a couple of uniform titles. These are titles which, as I said, are synthetic, that you make up yourself. They're filing titles designed to keep identical works together in your catalog. If you take the title only that's right on the record jacket or on the record label, you're going to get a mishmash of lots of different things. For example, one recording of Beethoven's Opus 67 is going to say the Fifth Symphony. You pick up the next record, it's going to say Symphony Number 5. You pick up the next one, Cinquième Symphonie, Fünfte Symphonie. I mean, okay, if you take just what's there, you've got four different filing arrangements for that same piece of music. There isn't time to go into how to construct the uniform titles any more than just to point out the two that are there and kind of, you just have to let it go at that for the moment. I'm trying to think if there are any other of these that would be really useful right now. I think what I'm going to do, I did want to emphasize something which was mentioned very much by Bill last time, and it's something that you really do have to think about, and that's what is called name authority work. And this would hold true for a composer. Actually, it holds true for several of these fields, but it would hold true for a composer and for all of your performers. If you put down Franz Peter Schubert, then make sure every single time that you put down Franz Peter Schubert, don't put down just Franz Schubert sometimes, because again, these computers are very unforgiving, and you're going to get 50 recordings of Franz Peter Schubert, and then it's going to start all over again alphabetizing with Franz Schubert. So always keep to the same form. If you're, I think it's probably a good idea for you to pick some type of an authority, such as, let's say, the Baker, Grove, New Grove. Pick something where the names are listed and write them down as you come to them, so that the next time you come to the same name, you'll cite the name the same way. I want to talk just very briefly about computer networks. Bill mentioned OCLC, which has its headquarters in Dublin, which is a suburb of Columbus, Ohio. We've got a little difference in the number of libraries, and I think I like mine better. 8,500 university, research, public, conservatory, and special libraries belong to the OCLC network, and this was taken from their last annual report, which showed a few less than this, and so I added a few, figuring that they probably have picked up some along the way. While most of these libraries are located in the United States, many are in Canada, United Kingdom, and Europe. There are even now participants in Japan, and they're bringing China into the picture. To give you an idea of OCLC size, more than 30 million books and 460 entries for sound recordings are included. And 60, this is kind of hard to imagine, but 60 transactions per second take place in the OCLC network, transaction of one kind or another. When I said 460,000 entries, it's for sound recordings. It's a little misleading, because one sound recording could have 10 pieces on it, and so you would have 10 entries for that one recording. But on the other hand, you might have a Wagner opera with five records and only one entry, and so they kind of balance out. How does all of this stuff about computer networks really help us as private record collectors? Provided you've got the proper communication hookup or proper software, arrangements can be made with the appropriate vendors, whether it's OCLC or Melville or Arlen or whatever the network is, to have the data downloaded from that system, whichever it happens to be, to probably into disks or tapes, which can then be loaded into your personal computer. You would then be able to take advantage of data which other collectors and libraries have provided for your discs. In other words, if the University of Kentucky has cataloged some fairly rare recording that you happen to also have, there's no point in your having to reinvent the wheel and catalog it yourself, and it's already been done. As was mentioned, also libraries quite often will provide more access points and historical information and much more information than the typical collector would just sitting down with a stack of records in his lap. And so if you've got the patience and the expertise, you can dig up all of this information fairly simply. For those collectors not directly involved in cataloging policies, it would be surprising to find out how much information is provided by catalogers, and you got some pretty good ideas from the transparencies, and it does tend to show why you can easily spend an hour or 2 hours if you wanted to be that methodical. In addition to the possibility of having the data downloaded from, let's say, OCLC, you can take the, you can make arrangements for a price. You can, all of this has a price tag. You can make arrangements with OCLC to have them process or have some, your local computer hacker around the block process these tapes and take advantage of some of OCLC's coded fields. There were lots of fields on these transparencies, of course, that, you know, weren't mentioned. A lot of little numbers and things that you probably have no idea what it is. I'll talk about very briefly one aspect of that in a minute. But you would be able to access this information fairly easily, so that if you wanted, for example, and this is an I tried to think of the ultimate search that you might want to have your catalog provide. And you would be able to request a list of compact discs in your collection which contain Italian solo cantatas composed before 1800, lasting more than 22 minutes, and which require the use of a mezzo-soprano, an organ, and a treble recorder. Now, try to do that in a card catalog. But you can do it, provided you have set up all of these different fields for the duration of the piece and the title and the genre and all of these different areas. If you have already set them up ahead of time, the computer will merge all of these different parameters and come up with the list that you need really rather quickly. The only thing I wanted to say in the end here is to explain what this stuff is in the rest of your handout. We've got example 5, example 6, and there isn't time nor really the necessity to go into all of this. I pulled out 2 fields from the OCLC sound recordings format manual for catalogers, and I'll tell you, if you try to figure out what all of this means on here, you'll go mad. I guarantee it. Even catalogers go mad in looking at it. But if you're not familiar with cataloging, it would even be more difficult. But it does, if you look, for instance, at the 045 chronological code or date time, if you look down at the bottom of the first page, you'll see what they call a BC table. On the next page is an AD table, which is probably the one you're going to be using more often. But they provided, if you have a piece that was composed in 197 BC, well then they have given you a way to code that. But for instance, if you, I'm trying to see, okay, down at the bottom of what is page 3, there's a little 3 up there in the corner I wrote in there, 1984, this field is the 045 field where they talk about the date of the composition. This little subfield B, you can not worry about right now because it gets into complications. But this gives you an idea that you can, just simply by putting in 1984, you can get, that is a way of coding a recording that was, a piece of music that was composed in 1984. And then you can go on, you can indicate spans of time. You can actually get down to a recording that was recorded, or a piece that was composed at 2 p.m. on May the 2nd, 1929. I mean, you can do these things. Obviously, you have to know how, and there isn't time to go into that. We'll go in one more, and then I'll philosophize. The number of instruments or voices is the 048 field, and that goes on for a few pages, where they've made a list on page 5 of all of the Western instruments. At least I don't see a Samus there, or a Koto, maybe it's on there. A list of the instruments and the voices and the performing ensembles. And you can use these codes or make up codes of your own to indicate the performing medium that's involved. So if you have a piano sonata, then you can indicate that the piano is what? It's probably a K-A, piano K? K-A is for keyboard instruments, piano. It goes on to the back gives you some more examples so that you can actually code a concerto for piano with orchestra, arranged for piano, concerto for guitar and orchestra. What I would say, since there isn't time to, or really the necessity to go into explaining all of this, what I'm trying to get at is that there are ways that you can make fields for your computer in which you can input all of these, or any of these that you think would be useful for you, all of these bits of information so that then you can retrieve them later. The whole point of the coding, obviously, is to make your chore of inputting the instruments and the time a little bit easier so that you don't have to write out saxophone and string orchestra, but you can have some kind of a coding system. I think that's all I'm going to say right now because we're moving along. What's happening with questions? Are we going to be is there time for questions?
We have 3 minutes. Since you started a little late, we have 3 minutes maybe for 2 questions for any one of you.
Oh, we mean what it mean, what that stands for? Online, online college. Wait, don't go away. I should know this.
Here. Actually, it doesn't really stand for anything anymore, really, doesn't it?
Online Computer Library Center is what it stands for. It used to have another abbreviation in its early days.
But college, I think, as I recall.
That's right. That's right. But they didn't want to get, I guess they felt that that gave it too local an emphasis that they left in Ohio as part of the abbreviation. So now it's the Online Computer Library Center. Yes?
I'd like to make a comment, if I may. The concept of uniform titles and the concept of authority names is extremely useful to private collectors. However, I think it needs to be emphasized that those are also technical terms, and that if the private collector does not have access, either through online hookup or visiting a library source, to call them uniform titles in or authority name forms in his own catalog when he attempts then to deal with a library or a university to give his collection or to try to relate to it, it can cause in the long run some extreme confusion. So I really suggest that we private collectors use it, but be very careful about our terminology so that we don't end up actually confusing two different things.
The two things being the uniform title and the title that's on the item?
No.
No.
I'm talking about what I call a reference title.
Yeah. Oh,
which
okay.
is what I would use, but I wouldn't call it a uniform title unless I have gone to a uniform title listing and pulled it out. And most of us don't have time or access to go to the right place and find out how it was done and what it is. And therefore, if we call it a uniform title, it can cause later confusion.
I see.
Call it a reference title, call it
filing title.
But it is a filing title, whatever is convenient to you. But don't call it a uniform title because that's actually a technical term.
Because then somebody might come along later and think that your work was gospel and pick it up and, okay. Yes.
This brings up a matter I brought up at MLA meetings. What we really need is a volume or set of volumes which are complete, inputable, formal listing for all the music in the world.
Yes, hear, hear.
Why did you do that, Steve?
You spare time.
Could we have that ready for the next meeting so we can just... Yeah, right. Yes.
One piece of information, related reading for ARS members 2 or 3 journals ago on the general topic of cataloging collections is a reprint from High Fidelity of David Hamilton. That's right. Get going.
Yeah, I'm sorry that I forgot to bring with me, you know, typical librarian, I forgot to bring with me an article that was in Stereo Review, I believe within the last, I know within the last 2 years, but not within the last year. And the author and the exact title escapes me, but it doesn't make any difference. The caption that was at the, it was an article, about 3 or 4 pages, telling you how to catalog your record collection using a PC. And the author gave various examples of word processing programs and database programs. And anyway, the caption that was in big print up at the top of the article, I spent an entire weekend cataloging my record collection. And let me tell you, unless this man has 9 records, it's going to take an awful lot longer to do it than that. I think that's all. Okay, thank you.